directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday once again, the 22nd of June in the glorious future year of 2024. And now you can hear me pouring plain soda water into a glass with a little bit of apple juice concentrate at the bottom. This is a tip for you. I guess the kids these days call them life hacks. I bought a syrup pitcher at a restaurant supply house. You may not have to go to one of those. You may be able to find it somewhere else. And I've been using it to keep juice concentrate in. And so I can just pour a little juice concentrate into a glass. And so you can avoid having to keep large jugs of juice already made up in your refrigerator. You could just put some water and maybe some ice into a glass and just pour the juice concentrate in. And of course, since I'm using soda water, it's especially convenient. So yes, I hope that's of some value to you. Now, I have no mail call today because I haven't been to the post office in a few days, and there wasn't anything of note when I did check it last. Remember, if you want me to read your letters out on the show, you first have to send them to me. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And now again, not only will I likely read whatever you send me, I will probably also send you something in return, assuming that you leave me with a return address. Let's see. Here's a couple of people showing up in comm. Hello, hello. Quentin, hello. Gemlog, hello. DJ Marcus. So the first thing I want to do is congratulate the folks at Ontario Power Generation's Darlington Station. You may remember me in the past congratulating them for a continuous run of over 1,100 days at full power, more than 3 solid years. That was on Reactor 1. Reactor 3 has been going through what they call major component replacement. This is the refurbishment that has to be done every 30 years to keep the reactor operating, and includes removing all of the 480 pressure tubes from the reactor and replacing them. I think it's 480, somewhere around there. That was the standard number, but some reactors have more, some fewer. Anyway, but yeah, 480 or so pressure tubes all removed and replaced, and they're good for another 30 years. They finished this work 169 days ahead of schedule. That's a week less than 6 months. Which means, of course, among many other things, that OPG is not going to have to find other power generation for the quantity of 6 months times 900 megawatts, very nearly half a gigawatt year. That by itself is a savings. So anybody who thinks that nuclear energy projects have to take longer and cost more should really talk to the people at OPG, because they don't seem to agree. They seem to know what they're doing. Another point to consider You know, why should nuclear energy, after all, take longer and cost more? You may remember me having quoted Augustin Shevchik of the Czechoslovakian delegation to the 1955 Geneva Conference, pointing that out that in comparison with what we now call renewable energy, nuclear uses far less land and far less raw materials, which are things the prices of which can only rise. It uses skill and technique and know-how, the prices of which generally fall. So, from an intrinsic point of view, from a point of view of intrinsic cost factors, factors of production as the economists refer to them, it appears that nuclear ought to be our lowest cost energy option, or at least getting cheaper in comparison to all the alternatives all the time. Now, if that's not happening, we do have to come up with a reason why it's not happening. And to a great extent, I would say, that reason is simply that it's treated as an abnormal technology. You know, if it were treated by the same ground rules as other industrial technologies, if it were accepted as a permanent and normal part of our technological picture, and not required every single time to justify itself, right? Nuclear energy is continually being asked for justifications. Justifications why you build a nuclear power plant at all. Justifications why you would ever use nuclear energy at all. These are not justifications that people ask for, generally speaking, with respect to other technologies. And so when you have to fight just to exist, obviously nuclear is going to take longer and cost more than it should. If it were treated on a level playing field with other industrial energy options, presumably it would be a lot cheaper than it is, and it would be in the bottom rank as far as price with the various energy options that are out there. If you want to look at some information on that OPG refurbishment project, sdf.org/L/1Z3, that's 1Zulu3, sdf.org/L/1Zulu3. And the important point, of course, is that for this major component refurbishment and the parallel program at Bruce to be going forward means that the factories that make CANDU components are in operation. And they're presumably going to continue in operation if only because of the refurbishment work that's now planned for Pickering Units 5 through 8, which will again require new pressure tubes and new boilers and various other things like that, all the stuff that wears out. And so now would be the perfect time to buy more CANDU reactors because the factories that make the parts are in operation, and it's always easier to increase the output of a factory that's operating than it is to start up a completely new process line. Now, I had a query from a listener who said that he was talking about nuclear power during lunch at the tree farm where he works, and that the objection had been raised that the plutonium economy implied by the use of breeder reactors would make nuclear weapons proliferation a major problem. Ubiquitous nuclear weapons. This was a claim that's been raised from time to time, and I don't think it's as solid an objection as it appears to be, for a couple of reasons. The first and most basic one, of course, is that building nuclear weapons is not simply a question of technical capability. It's a question of a political decision, right? So Sweden, the only country in which there's been an open and democratic debate over whether or not to build nuclear weapons, had the capability to do it from the 1950s onward, but never did it. They voted not to do it. Very interesting example here. I was just scanning another issue of Atom, and if you want to see my scanned issues of Atom, and even for the ones I haven't scanned, covers and contents listings, various things like that, go to sdf.org/l/1ys. That's sdf.org/l/1YankeeSierra. Anyway, I was scanning an issue which had a speech from Indira Gandhi, who was then the head of the government in India, in 1983, saying, India does not have nuclear weapons, India does not want nuclear weapons, India is not pursuing nuclear weapons. Now, that sounds like a very strange thing to say, considering, of course, that India conducted an underground test of a nuclear explosive in 1974. So, was she just outright lying at assuming no one would call her on it? Or was she speaking the truth by some definition? Right. Sometimes with politicians, you have to ask, what does the thing you just said actually mean? Because it's entirely plausible, and I think very likely, that India in 1983 had no nuclear weapons and was not pursuing it. They had the technology to build nuclear explosives. That had been demonstrated. But going from the technology of building a nuclear explosive to an actual deliverable weapon and then building a military force's worth of those weapons, those are two big steps. And I very much suspect that at the time, India found it much cheaper and safer to diplomatically play off its two main military threats against each other, those being the USSR and Communist China. You know, we always think of the long-running border conflict between Pakistan and India over Kashmir. We often forget that China has occupied the northern part of Kashmir for more than 50 years. So the two major threats to India were the Soviet Union and China, and up to 1990, they were able to play them against each other. After 1990, with the Soviet Union having utterly collapsed, and with China rapidly becoming both economically and militarily more powerful, only then did India have a reason to start turning the technology of nuclear explosives into actual nuclear armaments. Now, beyond that, and I find this intriguing, you know, so the argument is essentially that the technical capability for nuclear power and the availability of quantities of fissile material will make it easier to build nuclear weapons. In principle, that's true, but it's also not all that relevant. If we look at the countries which have developed nuclear weapons, most of them didn't possess nuclear power technology at the time. And from the United States of America back in 1945 to North Korea, you know, about 15 years ago, that didn't seem to stop them. Not having nuclear power doesn't stop countries from building nuclear weapons. So saying that nuclear power and its technologies will make it easier for countries to build nuclear weapons is probably somewhat misleading. But also, if you happen to have a copy of BLAST, if not, go to atomicblog.st and you can download it there or request a copy by mail. But if you happen to have a copy of BLAST number 1, in the final print version, in the centerfold, on, should be page 14, I think, is a diagram which shows one technical means by which concerns about weapons proliferation in a regenerative nuclear energy economy with breeder reactors can be reduced. And that is by locating all the breeder reactors and the fuel processing facilities, the chemical reprocessing and fuel manufacturing facilities, on a single site, which can then be placed not only under close inspection, but under international control, possibly by a multinational consortium. And I'm far from the first person to recommend or suggest this, right? Because as it turns out, it is entirely possible to operate a power system with two types of reactors, with fast neutron breeder reactors, which generate power and add excess fissile material, and slow neutron converter reactors, which generate power and consume fissile material, and have 2 to 3 times the installed power of converter reactors as of breeders, and operate those converters outside the fence, as it were, and the breeders inside the fence, right? This only works if you have a very efficient converter, such as the CANDU system, which requires relatively little makeup fissile material per year. And the advantage of it is that it also requires very dilute fissile material. If you think of the fuel assembly of a breeder reactor may have several hundred fuel assemblies, each of which contains roughly 100 kilograms of uranium-plutonium alloy metal. And that uranium-plutonium alloy is about 20% plutonium. So one of those assemblies would contain about 20 kilograms of plutonium. You need about 6 kilograms to build a bomb. So even one of those assemblies going missing would be a really big problem. On the other hand, a CANDU-type fuel bundle, which is made up of uranium enriched with some proportion of uranium-233 scavenged from thorium and some proportion of plutonium, that fuel bundle has a mass of about 30 kilograms and contains about 5 grams per kilogram of plutonium. That plutonium is the only separable fissile material, since any uranium-233 and U-235 that it contains are blended in with U-238. You'd need isotope separation capability to get those out, in which case you could make bombs using natural uranium out of the ground, right? Okay, so we're talking about whether or not it makes it easier, right? And so the CANDU fuel bundle, containing 30 kilograms of fuel, contains about 150 grams of plutonium. So you'd need 40 of those bundles to obtain the 6 kilograms of plutonium you need for making a bomb. 40 bundles going missing is very unlikely. That's something, it's very easy to stop somebody from stealing 40 bundles, particularly when, of course, you've got the used fuel is being shipped back from the reactor to the fuel cycle site, where the uranium and plutonium and thorium are all separated and purified of their waste products, and then remanufactured into new fuel, which means that the very heavy shielded flasks are having to come from the reactor site to the fuel cycle site. Well, they also have to go back so they can be reused, which means that you take the new fuel, and you put it in those flasks, which are very heavy, impossible to breach even with an anti-tank weapon, very difficult to steal, right? And so you just send them back and forth. And if necessary or desirable, you could even put powerful radioactive sources inside the flasks on their way to the power plant, or you could even shuffle the newly manufactured fuel bundles through a reactor at the fuel cycle site, simply to make them inherently radioactive and therefore very difficult to handle without the kind of large-scale specialized machinery that you have at the power plant. So that's a technical means that makes diversion of fissile material very challenging, so that it's never present outside a heavily safeguarded site under international control, except in a very dilute form that's difficult to obtain and difficult to do anything with. And I do not know what countries still have international postal money orders. I always say my favorite bearer instrument is the U.S. Postal Service domestic money order. If you want to send me funds from outside the USA and you can get an international postal money order, I will happily accept them. I will also say if you're in Canada or Europe, just plain cash of your country will probably work fine, because I'm likely to visit Canada sometime soon. I'm probably in August, so that I can go see Bruce take the tour that they do. And I'm going to visit Europe shortly after that. So, just a thought, spurred on by conversations in Calm. But, you know, people start wars over fuel. You have to ask, why would anyone want a nuclear weapon? And that's, as I always say, Nuclear weapons are not the problem. Weapons and wars in general are the problem, right? The two world wars of the 20th century proved that you can decivilize continents, or even on a global scale, without nuclear weapons. And so the real threat is war itself. Why do people fight wars? Generally, to obtain something. Sometimes it's trade routes. Sometimes it's just for power and prestige. But frequently it's fuel. In the 20th century, wars over oil, right? The Japanese invaded the Dutch East Indies to gain control of their oil fields because they were under an oil embargo from the United States. And in passing, they attacked Pearl Harbor and Manila to neutralize the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. Before the 20th century, wars were often fought over land, and in pre-industrial societies, land is synonymous with energy, because land is what provides food for people who work, it provides fodder for animals which work, and it provides firewood, the three Fs which are energy in a pre-industrial society. Food, fodder, and firewood are all about land. And in a renewable energy society, right, some areas of land are much more suitable for wind and solar development and so on than others are. And so we can certainly imagine in a renewable energy society going back to fighting wars over the land most suitable for energy production. I hate to mention this, but, you know, even Hitler, his nominal rationale for trying to conquer all of Europe east to the Urals and exterminating the people who lived there, right, clearing as they referred to it, was to have that area available for producing biofuels in view of the prospective exhaustion, 300 years or so in the future, of the coal measures in Germany, with the idea that the German nation would then be able to use all that land for producing biofuels and thus maintain its prosperity. Now, my main comment here is that Hitler wasn't a particularly intelligent or educated person, and so one shouldn't necessarily, and undoubtedly had many other reasons for doing the things that he did, and so one shouldn't necessarily take that too seriously, but that was the rationale he put forward. I read that in one of his table talks. I'd picked up a book when was leafing through it, and that leapt out at me. Not a good idea to spend too much time immersing yourself in the mindset of a person like that, but it is occasionally useful. I remember a novel which included a couple of books in the narrative. One was called The Big Book of Unpleasant Things That Are Sometimes Useful to Know, and the second book was called The Big Book of Things That Are Not Good to Know at All. Anyway, let's see. Another thought, I was online somewhere and somebody was talking about the Dust Bowl and how that incredible ecological catastrophe, the loss, just total loss, of large areas of what had been up to then the most productive farmland in the world for a couple of generations, was an enormous, not merely a physical and economic catastrophe, but also a kind of psychic wound, which very much sensitized people to the idea of ecological disaster and ecological collapse in a way which really helps to explain things like Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring and the reaction it generated, no relation, things like the behavior and attitudes taken by the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s particularly, which we are unfortunately still having to deal with today, when they opposed nuclear energy, and this came out in debates in Britain, although it was rapidly ignored again, that they opposed nuclear energy because they believed that without nuclear energy, industrial society would grind to a halt, and they believed that industrial society, if not forced to grind to a halt, would rapidly consume all of the depletable mineral resources and then crash. The possibility, as pointed out by Alvin Weinberg back in the 1950s, that an industrial society with enough energy could obtain its necessary minerals from as dilute sources as average continental rock or seawater, really just wasn't in their minds. Of course, in passing, The person talking about this, because this is the kind of part of the internet it was, made some reference to indigenous stewards of the land, and that how the, you know, taking the land away from the Native Americans was their reason for the Dust Bowl. Well, I mean, that might be true, but it also reveals an attitude which I have to point out, once again, your survivorship bias is showing. The fact is, archaeological and paleontological record, and to an extent the historical record, show us ecological catastrophes over and over and over again, in which populations collapsed, entire cultures disappeared, because whatever they had been doing stopped working. And maybe it stopped working because of climate shifts, maybe it stopped working because of wars, maybe it stopped working just because of overextension. Which is the threat that people see with industrial society, that it succeeds so well that it ultimately fails because you keep doing more and more until you can't do more anymore. But this has affected all kinds of societies, from hunter-gatherer bands, which usually disappear without ever generating any notice, all the way to sophisticated civilizations such as the classical Maya, whose civilization imploded in the 13th century. Their written language passed out of use. The number of Maya collapsed. The size of their... They went from cities to villages and basically still haven't recovered. So, if you have indigenous people whose strategies have been working for a while, by all means study them, but don't think that they're magic. It's just that they've survived. The fact that Western civilization survived the Dust Bowl and survived without a massive population collapse is really impressive. It's pretty much the first time that anybody's succeeded in surviving an ecological catastrophe without having their population fall by at least half, if not 90%. We're actually doing surprisingly well by that particular standard, of which all I have to say is that the lessons of ecology are harsh lessons, and they are typically learned in the classroom of famine, who is the harshest of schoolmistresses. Beyond that, I want to just complain here for a moment, particularly about people on the internet, who read one explainer article and they think they understand a subject and then go on and decide to argue with me when I own textbooks on the subject. The specific thing that came up in SDF Mastodon somehow was frequency control. And somebody was claiming that nuclear power can never replace fossil fuels because nuclear power plants can't do primary control on a grid system. Now, this is nonsense. Some nuclear power plants can and some cannot. You probably have no idea how frequency control is done, but basically, in a power system, if you have a generator which is running at a constant load, and more load comes on the system, the generator will slow down. And if load drops off the system, this generator will speed up. And this changes the alternating current frequency, which is highly undesirable, because with all of the synchronous machines on the system, it'll cause huge voltage and current spikes, and just it can crash your power system. You don't want that. So you have to, when the generator wants to slow down, you have to speed it back up again, and vice versa. Now, some power stations just run with the throttle valve at a constant setting, in which case they don't do frequency control. Three Mile Island Unit 2, judging from the accident that happened there, was probably a plant that could not do frequency control. Bruce, on the other hand, is a plant that can do frequency control. What's the difference? Well, it's simply that you can't increase a fossil fuel burner or a reactor power level rapidly enough to match changes in demand. If you have a big steam drum, which CANDUs typically have, when the throttle valve opens wider, the initial energy needed is delivered from that stored energy in the steam drum. And if you have a condenser, you bypass the steam to the condenser, the valve closes down, and you start dumping steam to the condenser until you back off in the reactor power. Bruce actually has condensers rated for 100% of full load because CANDU fuel is so cheap, it doesn't make any sense to back off reactor power. Whereas Three Mile Island Unit 2 had these once-through boilers that could not vary their output in response to demand changes, and when the turbine tripped off the system, they had to scram the reactor. Anyway, coming up next is the dubious...